Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another edition of the New Africa Business Association Black Belt Wall Street Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, speaking to you live from Washington, D.C., Bilal Masadiq Bynum, along with my co-host.
Abdul Aziz Shaheed, and greetings to our audience, and assalamu alaikum to you, Brother Bilal.
Walaikum salam, Brother Aziz. How are you this evening?
Oh, everything's good, bro. Good. Looking forward to the show tonight.
Yeah, me too. Of course, we've been off for a couple of weeks. And you know how it is when you're off for a week or two, your audience has a tendency to diminish a little bit, but we're back tonight.
Yes.
We're back tonight.
Yes, I am. Yeah, a little, how was the vacation or the trip to the South?
Oh, it was very good. My trip, my reason for going down, my wife is from the South, Birmingham, Alabama, and she hasn't seen her family for quite a while, so I told her she needed to go see her family. So even though my mobility is not that good anymore because of Parkinson's, we took, and for the first time, Brother Aziz took Amtrak. Amtrak, and I want to advertise, promote, say anything. I don't know anything about Amtrak. That was my first time ever using their services. But I have to say, Brother Amtrak, the employees are very professional. The employees are very diverse. Very diverse. And couldn't be no more professional. And as far as the
How was the seating on there?
I'm sorry?
How was the seating on the rail?
How was the what now?
The seating.
I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking me. Are you saying seating?
Can you hear it all?
No.
The seating. Where the seating?
Oh, you mean seating? Oh, seating.
Seating.
Wait a minute, brother. Are we talking about sitting down?
Yes, we're talking about S-E-A-T-I-N-G, seating.
Okay, I wasn't for sure. Well, the reason I'm stuttering is because that's what I was just getting ready to give you some information on. That was my first time riding on the Amtrak. And, of course, you can go in the regular coach and deal with the lounges and all like that. But I went into the sleepers department. And I rented a sleeper. And when you rent a sleeper, then now you're in your own private setting, and in that sleeper you have your lounge where you can be in your own private lounge where you have the scenic view of the trip itself. And I can tell you, there's nothing like viewing the countryside like being on a train, because the train, you're going through the wooded parts of the country, parts that you don't normally see from a highway. And of course, you know how train tracks go. Most train tracks, you know, you see them come out in the open public, but most of the time they disappear right on into the woods. And your rail services is going to be taking you into deep wooded parts of the country, parts that you can't see from the air. And like I said, parts that you probably never drive to, even though you live in the state. And that was an episode.
Yeah.
That scenic view was an experience within itself. But it's when you get back to the seating part, answering your question, you can't get any more comfortable. And like I said, I was in this the private sleepers compartments, but you can't get no more comfortable than that train. Of course, the ride is a little shaky and a little rocky. You get, might start off, but very comfortable. And it's and of course it's the type of trip where you probably would need time. And, you know, because again, if you're in a rush or something, I would suggest the train. But if you got time to kick back and relax and enjoy your trip, 4 hours or more, I would say, I think it's a wonderful way of traveling, and I am looking forward to continuing to travel on Amtrak. It was an experience, especially, I'm gonna tell you, this country, when, like I said, when you're able to look at the, when you're able to look at the industrialization of this country, when you're able to actually witness, and I'll say the industrialization starting right from Washington, D.C., and start going on into the countryside, and like I said, going through these wooded areas and all these different towns and cities and places, along with the popular cities and places. But when I talk about the industrialization, first you see it on the rail system itself. How, when it comes to the produce that we produce, I'm saying anywhere from large steel produce, oil, or what have you, to just about anything else that we're producing in this country or we're having shipped into the country, because you see these trains and you see these huge crates, and these crates may have, well, they did, they just came off somebody's ship. And from the ship, they've been placed onto the rail system. And from the rail system, they're being sent, I know, all over the country. And to see the might of all of that, when you see all of these trains and they all flying by each other so close together that you you couldn't put a toothpick out the window, and that toothpick wouldn't touch a powerful locomotive flying past you at a high rate of speed. But I'm saying carrying cargo that is totally amazing. So there's no doubt about it. America is one of the most powerful and most industrialized country in the entire world. And every day we wake up, that industrialization. Now, I say we wake up, but it's even going on at night too. That industrialization is going on. So when you start talking about, and I start helping out, but to think, now that I went into the deep south, and that's where our power is at. is in the deep south.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw things, Brother Aziz, I even saw how military tanks, from one end to the finishing end, how they were made, and fields of them out there where they are made and ready to be shipped, the might of this country. And but I'm just saying that's just a taste of it. So many things you see, the huge car dealerships coming out the south and shipping all kinds of material. And all of the huge manufacturers. I am in total belief that I don't see anyone who's living in the South being unemployed. If they are, it's because they may more or less may want to, or they may not be physically able. Because there's got to be so many jobs. Now, a lot of them are physical work, mind you. But the industrialization that goes on down there, and it's blue collar, but it's powerful and it's big. Powerful and big. And I'm saying, I mean, the big car dealerships and the things they build down there, it's phenomenal. And I was just amazed. Go right ahead. I'm sorry, brother. Go right ahead.
Brother Bilal, the South has always been more industrialist than the North. And especially in agriculture as well as other people. A lot of people think that Pittsburgh, they produce a lot of steel out of Pittsburgh.
Nah.
Well, Birmingham, Alabama, they produce a lot of steel out of that too.
Go right ahead. Huh? No, go right ahead. Go right ahead. No, continue.
And a lot of that steel that was produced in Birmingham went right down there to the shipyards in Mobile to build those big ships that they built during World War One and Two.
Yeah.
You know, and as well as a lot of folks don't know, starting in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, the military owns thousands of acres of land.
Oh, my.
And on that land, yeah. And they own a lot of prime land.
I witnessed it, Aziz. I actually witnessed what you're saying. I tell you, going back to this a plant that, and I won't say the name of the plant. I don't know. It could be a secret or something. But I saw where not only did I see where you're talking about the steel and the raw material and everything from one end of a huge plant with tens of thousands of cars. I could only see the cars, but I know the cars represented employees working inside of these plants. And, man, it was going on as far as, and I'm saying now I'm on a moving train. And I'm watching from one end to the furthest end. And when you get to the furthest end, you see many different functions of the plant. But when you get to the right end, and I kept on saying to myself, I wonder what is the finished product of this plant. But as I moved and moved and kept on, and I'm on a moving train, mind you, when I got to the end of that plant, that's when I started seeing these military tanks, brand new ones. And I saw, and like you said, as far as the land.
Yeah.
That land continued, brother. That train drove I don't know how long, and those tanks and that land continued. And this is a moving train moving at top speed. So I'm saying, and it's right on the railroad where they're making these tanks and sending them all over the world. So we're a powerful country. We're a powerful country. I couldn't help but think of the black soil. Think about it. I was down south. I was looking at all those African Americans. Plenty of African Americans are in the south.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept on looking
at all of them. You know,
Anyway, like I said, I kept on observing all of these African Americans in the South, and along with this huge industrialization that I am experiencing, and this might of productivity going on, I couldn't help but to think about the black soil.
Yeah.
And I am saying, just think from Texas and all of these African Americans you're seeing down here in Alabama, but all of this exists in all the states in the South, all the way from Texas, all the way from Texas throughout the South. And then in Virginia, but you have to include Maryland and Delaware because they are part of that black soil, and that's what the white man called it back in the day.
Yeah.
But it was Booker T. Washington. It was Booker T. Washington who turned the name from the black soil to Black Belt Wall Street. But of course, before Black Belt Wall Street, but before Booker T. Washington, during the time it was the black soil, and the reason they call it the black soil, because this is where slaves, the highest concentration of slaves was put into all of these states. And I said these states run from Texas up to Virginia, but you have to include Maryland and Delaware because they were slave owners. It was part of the black soil, and it was that black soil and the produce or the production of those slaves that made this country the most wealthiest country in the world. And today, I was able to really, like I said, witness this from Washington, D.C., all the way to Birmingham, Alabama. And I can't tell you how many little towns, big towns, towns back in the woods, towns on top of hills and over valleys. I experienced it all. And everywhere I experienced, I don't care where I looked out as far as that scenic view. And like I said, you're talking blue collar. 90% of everything is blue collar. You saw both the old white man and the black man all throughout all of these cities and towns and what have you. So again, that black soil and African Americans and white Americans and the history that they have had for so many years. I don't know why in the world with such blessings from Almighty God that this country has, these human beings would want to go through racism. Because when it really comes right down to it, from my observation, white folks seem to get along better with black folks than they do with their own kind.
Yep.
It seems like they trust the black man more than they do his own kind. I mean, and I was looking at this. I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, wait a minute, I'm down here in Alabama. And I know how the laws are. You got them George Wallace laws still down there. And the George Wallace ways, and I mean, everybody acknowledges that. White folks do and the black folks do. They acknowledge it. They don't mind talking to you about it. But I'm saying, why in the hell do they keep continuing with this stupid stuff of hate and racism when they don't have no one else? White man ain't got nowhere else to go in this world that he can be accepted.
Yeah.
The black man ain't got nowhere else to go. African American ain't got nowhere else to go in this world where he can be accepted. But they have made a very powerful nation for themselves. And boy, oh boy, oh boy. Like I said, the success that we have in this country, but the stupidity that goes along with it, I mean, I just do not understand it. But anyway, that was my experience.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm just getting back here, but, you know, business, that's what I'm always observing. Is but you know,
you
one
see
thing
many farms down there.
One thing I do want to mention, though, Brother Aziz, you see, when it comes to disasters, and I know Sister Aisha said this many a time, but you don't really get a real good input on anything until you actually experience it. But when it comes to disasters, no one is no more prepared for any type of disaster than an African American. I mean, that because again, the black soil and slavery, the biggest disaster that any human being could ever have ever gone through and could possibly ever go through, has occurred with us. But along with the poverty and everything else, but at the same time, we have had great success. Our biggest success is making America as rich as she is today. Black man is what made America rich. A black soil can't do nothing without someone working the fields. We know who worked the fields.
Yes.
And so again, so there's the biggest disaster, but I'm saying disasters that came after that. And we know, going back to Nat Turner, we know the history and the story about the disasters that went down there during the early 1500s. We know the disasters of Black Belt Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We know the disasters of sharecropping and how we had to put all of those disasters, Americans had to pull ourselves out of it, oneself. At no point in history have anyone ever came and give us the success that we've given ourselves. But every time we give ourselves that success, we are literally attacked physically. And it starts with our own government. And these militias.
Every time.
And the Ku Klux Klan. And all this other white supremacy. And even today, the politics that we're on right now, could it be any more sillier?
Brother, one thing.
Don't even want to know anything about equality and what is equitable. And they don't even want to know anything like that. Truth. They hate you for trying to express the truth. So again, how do you deal with but like I said, so African Americans have had to bring themselves out of a disaster situations, and we've been doing it ever since we've been here. So again, prepare for natural disasters and the trainings that we're getting now, professional training that we're getting now, with this type of understanding and with this type of knowledge, what we used to say, hard time is coming. And then going back to that black soil again, and I have to go back to it because I thought about again, that heavy production from the soil. But you know, the soil and the heavy production, you normally can only get the heavy production during the seasons of growth. So again, when the cold weather comes in, is a time now for, as far as the production from the soil, we have to wait now until the winter is over and become productive again the following spring. But like the sister has said many times, and of course we've lived it, and you've heard folks talk about hard times is coming, and that's what they prepare for, is the hard times coming the next 3 or 4 months of the winter. The hard times is coming, we've got to prepare. They was preparing for natural disasters back in those days. They just didn't know. The only thing they could call it was hard times. They didn't know disasters and realizing preparedness for disasters. So we're on to, so again, Black Belt Wall Street. And I'm going to tell you what we're doing, and I know we ain't nothing but a little small station. It comes on every Wednesday, but we've been coming on now for about 6 or 7 years. And what we're doing, we must continue to do, because African Americans don't have channels of communications. And because we have to deal with others' communications, it puts us against each other. Or it makes us non-productive because we're not involved. And that's the way this country make it look like.
Yeah.
Make it look like we as African Americans are non-involved when we're the ones who made the entire country rich. And all of these folks who are running on calling themselves white supremacists and filthy rich, they're that way because of black slavery. And again, and I would say enjoy yourself on this earth for a little while, because I think there's a price to be paid. It's at a later point after this first life. I'm going to leave it alone at that point, Brother Isaac, because again, I'm getting away from business and getting into something else, and I didn't want frustrations to come in. But when you start thinking about some of this, you have to think of a little frustration, because it is frustrating to realize the people who have done so much for this country and have given the country the wealth of the wealthiest nation in the entire world, and to be treated as if we are insignificant. We have to do something about that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go right ahead, Brother Isaac.
Well, you know, coming up down south, I'm in Alabama, a place called Fairhope, Alabama, Baldwin County. Well, that's the biggest county in Alabama, Baldwin County. Well, there was nothing but farming all around where I lived, and across the bay from us, 21 miles of the city of Mobile. And over on the side of town where we lived, it wasn't no big grocery stores or nothing like that in the black section or in town, period. And coming up when I was a kid, the only thing I knew that my people bought from a store was what they call light bread, which was white bread that you make sandwiches out of. Other than that, everything we ever ate coming up as a youngster, it was grown and made around there. I used to sit down and churn the milk, the buttermilk. Grandmama helped me doing that, me and my brothers and that, and make butter. She'd make butter out of that. Big preserve. I didn't even know that you sold preserves in stores, and it cost a lot of money, especially one of my favorite big preserves. Grandmama and Mama and them, they made all this stuff, fig preserve, pear, peach. They even made a preserve. A lot of people ain't never heard of watermelon rind preserve. And I mean, you know, all these things now, are sold in stores today, big time. Thick preserves that cost your arm and a leg for it. Slaughterhouses where a lot of African Americans work, slaughtering the animals and that for the general public. A lot of that stuff they threw away at the slaughterhouses. Cow feet, cow tails, pig feet, pig tails, pig guts that they call chitlins, cow tripe. All these things they threw away, but the blacks took all these things and they turned them into a delicacy. They cleaned them up, turned them into a delicacy, and they come up as part of the slave diet. Those same things the Caucasians stopped throwing away. Stop throwing them away and turn it into a new industry. Not only for blacks to buy as much as they wanted, but also white folks got to loving what they thought wasn't nothing and start eating it. Watermelons the same way. Black folks love watermelons just because white folks saw them throwing them away, spitting the seeds out. They thought watermelons was nasty. But when I was coming up as a kid, the watermelon rinds, the ones that weren't made in no preserve, of course that was thrown to the hogs. The hogs ate them, but the meat that we call it in the watermelon, we ate that. Oh, it's so much that we introduced, like the quilts that we had on our beds, brother, a lot of those quilts, grandmama, mama, aunt, different black ladies in the neighborhood, they made them quilts, and they wasn't for sale. They was on beds to keep our hands warm in those cold winters and that. And then you look around and you see later on, those same homemade quilts, white folks are selling them, brother, anywhere from $300 on up to $1,000 for quilts that's made, like the sisters made back in the day, and that some of them are still making. But the problem is, a lot of the material that they use to make the rags and stuff that they made quilts back in the day, cotton, wasn't no polyester around and all that then. It was just cotton and linen, and then they changed up with all these petrochemical fibers, making, you know, like all this polyester clothing. You wouldn't think that you could make a material that you could wear that's made out of oil. But it is. And if any fire hit it, it'll go up in flames quick. But all those type of things back in the day, the cotton garments and that, they make quilts out of them. They used to get flour. Used to come in sacks that was decorative, like cotton decorative, 10-pound, 20-pound sacks like that. And I know the grandparents and women back in those days, bro, they take those same cotton sacks, open them up, and make shirts out of them. Wash that material, make shirts out of you think it looked like something that was bought in the store. All those types of crafts and things our people did for survival, and now it's for people that have hobbies because they don't do things that way anymore. But one of the biggest things that I have a good knowledge of, like you and others that were raised during our times that were not raised in a city, we do have a good basic knowledge of what survival is about because that's what we were doing back then, surviving, because no one was making a large amount of money whatsoever. Whatever the wages any of our adult people were making, and that was very mediocre, and that's even if you had a college degree. Down the way, you were not getting paid. As I said, I had a cousin that was a teacher, had a college degree teaching, and he wasn't getting no money. He took a job at a major hotel as a doorman and made 20 times more money than he made as a teacher in the school system back in the day. But what I'm emphasizing is the fact that because we had to survive, that's what homes. All of the homes that I knew of in Alabama when I come up, the blacks live in, they built them. Rick R. Wooden homes. We had the skills in there. My great grandparents and uncles in that were brick masons and carpenters. My father was a plumber. He got his trade in the military. But all those, and in those days, of course, we didn't have a lot of codes like you have now for installing electricity and that. And back in that time, those electric companies would just bring the power lines down the neighborhood and that. But a lot of people would take the power and run it to their own house. And all the electric company would do is come and put a meter on the side of your house. They wouldn't come in and see how you had your wiring or nothing. You could set something up in there and be, if you do it wrong, it would cause the house to burn down. But again, you know, we're talking about people that's down in that black belt that's got to survive on their own mostly. And they have to come up with ideas to survive. We made our own food, clothing. We built our own shelter. And we looked out for one another. We had a lot of love for one another back in those days. I never saw my first person living on the street until I came to Washington, D.C. from Vietnam in 1969. I'd never seen anybody laying on the street in the United States sleeping. But it probably was in other big cities, but I'd never seen that. And I thought, I'd say, wow. And I know down home, down south, people, you know, they just wouldn't let you go around and live and lay around like that back then. And this was even Caucasians, white folks. They, you know, it just people had a lot more concern, but they didn't have to survive like we had to survive. And that's one of the things we need to do now, even though there's an app on the telephone in case, in a, it's called the Black Farmers app. And this is a number of young farmers that are leaving major cities in the north, buying land down in Georgia, primarily Georgia, Alabama, and the Carolinas. And because a lot of people from the Carolinas migrated up to D.C. and further on up north, Philly and New York. Like, so I can see the ancestors of those that migrated up there only for you know, better job opportunities, not because they wanted to leave home. And we've had people from in D.C. that you and I personally know, Brother Lyle, Sammy Mustafa, as well as some others. They've come up from down there since they retired and went back home in North Carolina and brought truckloads of watermelons and cantaloupes up here to sell to the people in the neighborhood, because this is what our people do down south, grow food and that. So if we could organize ourselves a little better in things like this, especially producing agriculture as we do today, all kind of commercial products, we could feed our own selves, there's no problem. So it's not that we're non-productive. It's that putting our collective business ideas as well as our collective funds, wherever you may live in the country, to organize a business that we have, that, you know, that we need in our communities and that. Because when we go into our communities today, I'm not going to say there's none, but you don't see many black ownership of any businesses whatsoever all throughout the country. And that's everywhere. I was born in Alabama, and when I go down there now, I never saw any Indians when I was coming up as a kid down there, Indians or Chinese or Japanese or people like that. The Mexicans were down there, but they were primarily workers in the fields for the agriculture. When the season was over with, they would go back down to Mexico. They would come up in buses and that, and they wouldn't be living in the best conditions on those farms, but they'd have a place wherein they would have their buses parked and all that, and they stayed there, and they worked out in the hot sun just like the African Americans. Maybe they were used to it a little even more. And that's how agriculture, that's how it was carried down there. But after that, they left. There wasn't no work to be done down in those places. So people had to hunker down for the winter and do a little menial job. So what it means was all summer long, when a lot of the people down south were working, they were saving their money, but they were also growing different crops and that. Different people had different things around that they traded off. But the women, at a certain point, they start canning certain vegetables, combination of vegetables, making what we call succotash, corn, tomatoes, all kind of stuff, squash, pickles, potatoes and things like that. They could last you for well into the winter when they were stored outside. And a lot of people don't know those little eyes that come out on potatoes when you have them for a long time. If you plant those eyes in the ground, they'll grow potatoes. That's actually a potato seed. Those eyes, those things that you see growing out on potatoes when you've had them too long, and you say, oh, they ain't no good no more. Yes, they are. All those little things, you can plant them, and they grow potatoes. So, you know, that living in that whole Black Belt area and that, it's always been productive when it came to food. It was very, very seldom you would see people that were living in that Black Belt, no matter what color they were, that were starving.
Yes, sir. I mean, I can appreciate, but when you start to, I just said you saying a moment ago, and this ain't nothing but the truth. This is not exaggeration. When it came to the Black Belt, when it came to the black soil, because the Black Belt is something that Booker T. Washington and then put together as who was a business association. But the black soil, which started it all, made America the richest country in the entire world. Then, and America is still the richest country in the entire world now. And what made America the richest country in the world was the slaves that had to work the fields, and the produce that they produced from those fields made America the richest country in the world then and now. So, when it comes to the black man's productivity, this thing about canning some food or doing something that can keep our values, our values are trillions and trillions times more valuable than what we might be expressing right now. No.
Yes, the black man's absolutely.
Value has, if you want to know the black man's value, you look at the United States. And now, as far as the black man himself, why aren't you on the receiving end of these values that you have produced? And like you said, yes, these slave owners, they became filthy rich on many of the produces that you produce. And it all came from the field. But whether it be your garments that you're wearing, whether it be clothes on your back, whether it be the buildings that you're living in, it was all produced by slaves. So again, we can make others that rich, of course we can do it for ourselves. But in order to do it for yourself, you must be able to survive in your community on the richness that you have produced. But the richness that has been produced in this country by African Americans, slavery and racism and everything else that goes along with slavery and racism, black folks that have been enduring for the last hundreds of years. And even when they were able to produce for themselves, they were attacked physically. Because why? White folks want black folks to be inferior to them, and they wanted to for this to happen by any means that they possibly can come up with. So again, this has already been demonstrated, but at the same time, that's just another disaster that African Americans have had to deal with. Like I said, we've dealt with many, many disasters, and we've come and we have come through. But so when it comes to disasters and the preparations for disasters, we are well equipped for that. But when it comes to our values, we have never been paid for our values. Therefore, it is time that we became very proactive and realize these values and doing something different than what we've already done. But we do know whatever we do, we're going to need land in order to do it. So with that said, let me, Sister Aisha, are you with us, or do we have a representative from?
Yes.
Okay, Sister
Aisha
is with us, and I'm getting ready to turn it right on over to you. But I do know that there was a sister that called in from the Muslim Business Council down there, David Hassan. The Muslims Business Counselor, and they are sponsoring a business trip. They're saying to Africa, and she had asked to come on to make that presentation, and I was saying that when she do come on, we're looking forward to asking the questions, because like I said, we are a valuable people with valuable knowledge, but the values we have shared here in the United States, we haven't been able to share in our own productions, but at the same time, we know we're valuable, and we have valuable product to offer still, whether it's here in the United States to these folks we call Caucasians or white folks or whatever they call themselves, slave masters or whatever they want to be. But if we can't be productive and be proactive in being productive right here, in America, then maybe we can be outside of America. And we know there are problems between African Americans and Africans, just like there are problems between African Americans and white folks. We're called into where we are really neutral. And as a neutral person, we have to think in terms of being neutral, because, again, we are not going to be tricked by either side again. But we would like to be proactive on whatever side we deal with, but it has to be some business dealings, and we do have to change things. That's what Black Belt Wall Street, New Africa Business Association, and the natural disasters that we're bringing into it is all about. So with that said, Sister Aisha,
I'm back,
and we're going to turn it over to you, Sister.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and good evening, everyone. And inshallah, good evening.
I might say, Sister Aisha, right at the moment, our audience is a little low, but you never know as we go along. So again, with that said, I am going to turn it over to you.
Yes. Well. We have an audience, and tonight we're going to have another special guest, old friend of mine for many years, pioneer who has absolutely been beneficial to his communities that he has served. And he's going to talk to us tonight about his personal experience with natural disasters. And he incurred devastation from both Andrew and Katrina.
Wow.
And so he's going to come on very shortly. His name is Hiron Mason. And Hiron, when you and I have told him to just announce his name, and then we'll start. I'll introduce him again and tell you what he's going to talk about. And we'll get a chance to listen to his firsthand experience of situations that occurred with his family and other families with these two natural disasters. And as you know, Andrew, prior to Hurricane Ian, was considered the most costly hurricane in this country. But Ian has now outstripped Andrew. But as soon as Hiron comes on, we are certainly let you hear from him. In the meantime, I simply want to talk to you about an issue that we are facing with our children. It's reported that anxiety amongst our children, young children, have increased tremendously, well as anxiety level. And this is becoming a health crisis, especially for our community, but all over the U.S. It's estimated today, based on research, that 1 in 5 adults have anxiety disorders. That's what's that, 20% of our population, and it's increasing. And we know that some of the causes of anxiety is uncertainty and fear and some other issues. But in this day of natural disaster, we're going to see this anxiety level increases. And surely, as the family is faced with issues regarding climate change, and they are in a state of increased anxiety, it's affecting our children tremendously, so much that it was in June of 22 when President Biden signed the Homeland Security for Children's Act into law. With the recognition that our children are facing a crisis situation, especially the ones below the age of 5 and all the way up to teenage years. Now, many of the public schools are instituting programs to test the anxiety level of our young people. But this Homeland Security Act for children, it requires it asks that all agencies to consider the needs of children in mission planning and execution. So whatever we do as a group here on Black Belt Wall Street, we must include our young people, our young children, because they are our future. And if we grow up a population of young people who are suffering from this anxiety disorder, it's going to weaken our society, and we don't want that, and we don't want that for our young children. So to decrease your anxiety, preparedness decreases your anxiety because you're still in control. When you're in control of your movements, the impact that disaster, whether it's a tornado, a flood, or whatever it's going to be, the impact it has on your family, when you can have some say-so in minimizing that impact, and we use the word mitigating the impact, it empowers you. When you are empowered, you do not have the fears all the time of devastation. When you are empowered, you take action. And it goes back to what Brother Aziz and Brother Bilal just said. When we were coming up, we didn't have social services and other agencies to look out for us. We had to do it ourselves. Folks, that's one of the ways we survived. We became empowered. We took our existence, our survival in our hands, and we knew exactly what we had to do. So my parents raised a very powerful young people as a result of that. And we didn't get anxious. The only time I remember being anxious is when I saw my mother or my father or my grandfather or my grandmother getting worried. When they got worried, I got worried. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, they were not worried. They just went into action. Mm-hmm. So therefore, when we had to go 3 months without any running water in the house, any water, we had to store up water. When we had to endure those sorts of things, I didn't worry about it as a little bitty girl because they were not worried. They knew exactly where to go down in the cellar to get this, to get that, and we did well. So if we're going to decrease this anxiety level in our young people, we as parents, we got to get tough. We've got to stand up and take control of our lives and stop waiting for the federal government to rescue us when we have a natural disaster, because it's not going to happen as mm-hmm. quickly as you want it to or that you need it to. And we can do it, folks. Have faith in yourself. Have confidence. There is nothing in this society that we cannot do. But we not doing it. And that's a personal choice. No longer can we say it's somebody else's fault that I act this way. That's not true. It's your fault that you act that way, the way you do. And if you don't take this time now, Flood is on your doorstep. If you don't take time now to get prepared, that's on you. And you have nobody to blame but yourself. Every tool in the society is available to you. And if you don't stop passing the buck and saying, I've got to wait for some public assistance, take action. Save your life. Save the lives of your children and your community and the people you love. And we can do it. We did it, and our parents didn't have the education that we have. And we have more education as a society of people than they did, but they were better off. They could make decisions and they could survive. Now we, with all of the education, resources, financial resources, all health resources, we have become dependents within ourselves, or we won't survive. We are still be dependent on someone else. So other day, and I'll say this, and if there's anyone want to stop me, you know, you just have to just jump right in and ask the question. Other day, last week, there was a hurricane in Nicaragua, Central America, right? Julia.
Mm-hmm.
I heard no one saying, let's watch out for Julia. Julia's over there in Nicaragua, in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it was a Category 1 hurricane. But if you remember, in 2020, we had a tropical storm called Eta. Eta came from Nicaragua, that hurricane, Category 5. And it devastated the Florida area. But we did not talk about it. the news reporters didn't say, be on guard, remember the history. The history is with Etta coming from Central America that devastated us here in the U.S. This is the kind of information we have to learn ourselves. We can't depend on other people and other agencies to tell us everything. I had mentioned Etta many times on this radio broadcast. Did anybody remember that it was the storm from Nicaragua, Central America, that devastated us back in 2020? We're going to have to start thinking these disasters, folks, because the consequences are becoming more impactful on our lives, and especially on the lives of our children. And when those schools send you messages, parents, telling you that your child stay on task, it has a stubborn personality, don't want to do anything. When they tell you that they can't be still, or they cry all the time, think about the household. Think about what that child is going through. When you sit down with your child and you have a plan for emergency plan in place, they get excited. They feel confident. They feel assured. Because remember, these little folks, they are hearing about the storms too. They go to school. They see the news. They know about the storm. They may not be able to articulate it to you, but they know about it. But if you as parents are not stepping up to the plate to make those children, to get them to a point where they feel secure, it's on you. You can do it. Get prepared. And when they see the preparedness efforts taking place in the house, they know that mama and daddy or mama by herself is going to take care of them and it will be okay. That's what children want to know. Mm-hmm. So we can do a lot, but we are not, because we believe that after the storm, the federal agency is going to come there and rescue us. Well, they might get there, or they might not get there in 72 hours. You're on your own. But why wait? Why wait for them to possibly come? And now with the devastation that's taken place already that they're dealing with, the most costly storm hurricane to date, Ian, that just occurred, what, a week or so ago, at the tune of $47 billion, and it's still increasing in cost. They are busy, busy. They might not be able to get to you. So let's not depend on that. Yes.
This brother Aziz, I wanted to say that in the process of what you were talking about the children having these anxiety attacks and everything, I heard something mentioned about that before. On the news, and I was going to say there was a FEMA session offered in the county that I live in, Maryland, around the 28th of this month the 28th of September, and they didn't have a big turnout or whatever, and I know you said about FEMA over the years have only got a 2% participation from the population, American population. In stating all of that, a question to you would be, how we got to figure out a way to have some type of awareness network among the people that's going to be superior to FEMA's, because it seems to be that the people are not, no matter whatever, has not been able to get into the minds of the people that, hey, you can't wait till the last minute anymore. What do you think is one of the primary reasons that people just aren't being receptive to information that's needed for their survival?
Well, yeah, first of all, yes, you're right in the sense that that quote that you made, FEMA said that since 2013, preparedness has increased in the U.S. by only 2%. They didn't say only 2%. They said 2%. The only comes from in. So, and they are the number one agency with the resources to call to get that number up. But it has not since 2013, just 2%. I've seen FEMA does a great job in putting the material out. I'm part of that alliance, and I think that they have great information. I think the issue is, yes, it's very difficult for community people to understand the messaging sometimes, because it is a lot of it. But sometimes the language is not quite there for the community people. Many years, mm-hmm. and I think people have to go from being aware, everyone is aware in this society that we're in a state of an emergency with natural disasters. 99% of the people understand that. But being aware and being conscious aware is two different things. What we have to become is consciously aware. And that's what the training does. The training takes you from where you are, a state of awareness, conscious awareness. When you become conscious aware, you combine the knowledge you have from visualizing all of these disasters that take in place to a internal desire to do something about it, because you see and you feel how it is destroying your family, your assets, your way of life, and you get downright mad about it, and you want to do something about it. But it's not until you begin to internalize the hurt of these disasters do you become conscious. That's when you act. That's when you act. And that's where we have to take you in the training. That's the first step. Just being aware is not enough.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
We have
Sister Aisha, and everything that you're saying is 100% correct, but at the same time, when it comes to FEMA, and I don't care whether it's 2% trainees or 50% trainees, when FEMA's interest is FEMA's interest, and she takes her interest, and that interest is to white folks. And like I said, you have a guest coming on here, hopefully in just a few moments. They're going to tell you about a disaster that they went through with Katrina years ago, and they're still going through that disaster today. Just the hurricane that we just had a couple weeks ago, FEMA and all the rescuers from all over the country, they went down to Florida and all of the different places, South Carolinas and what have you. But each black neighborhood from every state said the same thing. No one came to us. And and you're saying it, and you're saying it exactly right. African Americans are saying no one came to us, and because they're realizing this, they're angry. And of course, I am like you. I think if they're angry, then they're looking to do something about it.
Absolutely.
But at the same
That's
time,
what
but at the same time, they don't know what to do about it because they're, again, they're dealing with the federal government, someone that they think they're supposed to be able to trust. So again, we must become very proactive and do something about this oneself. But you cannot do anything about a situation if you don't know and don't have the basic language to explain yourself.
That's
and
correct.
So, so you're absolutely right. It's time to get angry because, again, FEMA has already proven that she is for white folks. And when there is a disaster, the government is going for white folks, just like we over there in Ukraine. And now they're talking about going to Armageddon and blowing up the entire world because white folks are having conflict. So again, the federal government is for the disasters that we're having. And when FEMA, our federal government, it's all for white folks. And I don't see nothing changing that. And like you said, African Americans are now becoming angry because going all the way back to Katrina, on up to the present time, black concerns of the black disaster, no one is really giving a damn about. So, yes, it's we're the ones who are going to have to become proactive. We're the ones who are going to have to answer for our own communities. And I don't see where the federal government is going to stop us from doing that. As a matter of fact, I think if we, like you said, with the numbers, they're going to welcome us, and not only welcome, but we are enforcing our own powers when we go in large numbers. But when we sit around and like we have been doing, which is nothing, then that's what we're getting from it all. Absolutely nothing. So again, it was a statement that I wanted to make just from hearing what you were saying. I have a couple of opinions on the anger and we're getting from our young folks, but right now I'm gonna stay with the contents of what we're talking about rather than trying to skip from one to the other, because all of them are extremely, extremely important. But our natural disasters and learning to prepare for natural disasters and being able to answer the call after a disaster is going to be our communities and our communities' responsibility. Sister Aisha.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. And we can do this, folks. But, yeah, the folks are getting very angry. And when you get angry, you take action. And I'm not saying you got to be involved in a storm in order to take action. I don't wish that on anyone. But the reality is, until we internalize the threat of a natural disaster, we're not going to do anything. And that was proven to us back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. So we developed a community engagement program, and it swept the nation. And that program was going door to door, knocking on doors, sitting down with people, talking to them about civil rights.
And
that is how,
Sister Aisha, on that note that you just brought, now I want to go into my anger opinion with our young folks. And I think you just made the biggest comments that could be made as far as being proactive about doing something as far as saving our young folks. Because our young folks lost what we refused to allow to go on anymore, any longer, and that was segregation and racism. And even to the point as to where we was ready to die and take a bullet and give a bullet. But we wasn't going to stand for it no longer. And because of that attitude, and because of our disposition, not only attitude, we took a position. And because we took those direct positions, I remember in the late 70s and the early parts of the 80s, African Americans was doing so daggone well. It was African Americans said there was no more racism in America. That was 10 years after, or 20 years after, we got rid of the civil rights. We passed the civil rights bill. Things was going so well for Africa. That's when the EO, Department of EOEO, the Office of Economic Opportunities, the Kennedy Day. I mean, all types of programs was opening up where our generation was moving right on up the ladder. And like I said, they trained us. They put us through all kinds of colleges. They opened up all the colleges. They made certain nothing was to stand in our way. Or we made sure of it. But,
yeah.
And what we built, we loved. And so right on up until we allowed our schools to all be closed down in the black communities, and we started sending our kids off as to where they have no influenced by African Americans whatsoever. 90% of all the teachers in this country are Caucasians. That has existed even today. And so again, this anger that our babies have, that's because our babies hate themselves. Especially the dark complexion. The dark complexed one. See, you know, it's so bad in our African-American communities now where that old Willie Lynch theory of being light-skinned and big nose and big lips and all that nappy head, where that theory actually worked at some point because we was made to hate ourselves. Well, our generation, we actually loved ourselves. Black is beautiful. I mean, and even today, look at the Afrocentric, everything that's going on. Our kids love to put the braids in their hair. Our kids love to put on the Afrocentric look. But they hate each other. And that's where, and this hate is manifesting itself. And we can see it. I mean, every community you go into the black, like I said, I just came from the South. And I was talking about that wonderful industrialization and all of what I experienced. But I also experienced black folks at the lowest of the lowest as far as a people's. In the city of Birmingham, you have females running grown. I'm talking about mature females, homeless, nowhere to sleep at nighttime, sleeping on the street. Quite a few of them, and young folks going around and killing each other And everywhere you go, all and these are the suburbs of Alabama, and I'm telling everybody how pretty I think their city is as I move from place to place, and they say, "Oh, that's just that's external." Internal, I hear it everywhere I go how they're killing all over Birmingham. And then I was only there for a day or two, but I know that within that day or two, I didn't see no black unity. What to all I saw was look like black folks. They would barely speak to each other. And when you spoke to them, their greetings wasn't as friendly as yours. They might say something like, "Good morning." Might get something like that. But, and I'm saying this to say because I had some young black males, and I don't know, and I'm saying even with this attitude, but as I was getting out of my car or wherever I went, these young black males that didn't care too much look like for each other was opening the doors to me, even giving me fit. They didn't even know me. And these are young boys, 21, 22, and they all look like they've come from the hoodlums. Somebody might be I'm afraid to communicate with. But see, these are my peoples. I don't care if you're a rich black man or you're from the poorest, you are my peoples. And for some reason, yeah, like I said, these young boys give me the fist pump and call me sir. You see, it's we don't have that love. And I'm talking about adults. I ain't talking about kids. And I ain't talking about the adults of our generation. I'm talking about our kids, those who are 50 and below. The unity is gone. And this thing of black is beautiful and you are my brother's keeper, have no idea what you're talking about. And this is why I think we're having a large problem with anxiety. And I think our kids might be more affected from it than any other kids because our kids have to go through so darn much. Not only in their own community, but in the Caucasian community that is exciting all of this. So again, we have our work to cut out if we want to save. And I'm like you. Every time we open our mouth to do something, business or what have you, yes, I wish we have as many young folks as because on with us, because Sister Aisha, if our generation don't save the lost generation, I don't. We're going to be set back a long ways, because I mean, look at folks like Herschel Walker now. This is how white folks are manipulate the ranks. And our ranks now are speaking for white supremacy, for white supremacists. There was a time that couldn't have happened in our communities. So what's going on in our communities? And yes, we have to get to our young ones. And I'm afraid it's the grandparents that's going to have to say again, because our kids, and I'm saying our kids, our 50-year-old kids, they're not capable of saving the day because they went to the insane integrated schools, and they don't know anything about the black unity either. So how can they teach their kids they're having that black is beautiful when they don't even believe it? So again, yes, the subject of saving our kids from because anxiety, especially when you start talking about the five-year-olds. I know my granddaughter, and she was down in and just came back from Tampa down at the Disney, down at the Mouse, Mickey Mouse, a place down there in Florida. A week or so before the hurricane came, she was down in Tampa, Florida, with her first cousins. And her first cousins, they're all 5, 6 years old, just like she is. But when they got back to Washington, D.C., that's when the hurricanes was coming through that area. And my granddaughter asked me, "Granddaddy, is my first cousin going to die?"
Mm-mm.
From that hurricane.
She's already worried about it.
Wow.
You see how I had to get all the wish that I possibly could? We got to save our babies.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because they don't know. But when they ask you, "Is my cousin going to die?" just think if I had told her yes, it was a possibility. And she's only 5 years old. Think of how much I had to give her. I had to
They perceive a lot more than we imagine.
We got to save our babies. We got our work cut out for us. And this is no joke. I mean, hell, I'm sitting here now with tears in my eyes. This is
serious.
Well,
you know, you're absolutely right. And we're going
to
stay on
the babies. We got to save our babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm willing to do it even if I have to go out here in the streets where all the boys are shooting. I'm not scared of beating it. Look, these guys need reassurance, and I know they need it. And they're begging for it. But because they don't know anything else. They're just as illiterate as that bullet that they're shooting. So I'm going to turn it back to you, but I'm saying, what we're talking about is just not a conversation. And if others, regardless if they come on this station and get and start doing something pro, because if African Americans don't do something proactive, I mean, we're losing. And you have African Americans who are going to help you to be a loser. Folks like Hershey Walker. And there are many of them out there. And the ones that aren't out there can be bold. There was a time this couldn't have happened. There was a time this couldn't have happened. So, again, I have to share that from everything you brought up tonight, like I said, the disaster or saving our kids. We got to become very proactive in whatever we're going to do. And we got to do it.
Absolutely. You know, UNICEF, and we all have heard of UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund.
Yeah.
So they have stated that, and I think I've repeated this before, that 88% of the existing burden of diseases as a result of climate change is put on children under the age of 5. Can you imagine that? 88% of the existing burden of diseases as a result of climate change is put on children under the age of 5. And anxiety, a mental disease. And it's affecting our children, 88%. And like your granddaughter asked you, if another relative was going to die, I bet you didn't even think she was thinking like that.
No, I didn't. That's what knocked me down.
Right.
You didn't even know. You didn't even know.
I knew I had to give her the correct answer, and I had to give her a reassurance answer immediately.
But
and
she said the most critical.
She saw it the kid in her face. She was okay after hearing an adult giving her a proper explanation.
Absolutely.
She was all right after that.
Yes. And they rely on us. These children rely on us for our strength to protect them. And
right.
when they don't know, they, like your granddaughter, she knew to come to you and she'll get an answer. Can you imagine that child taking that fear to bed with her at night?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I couldn't let that happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. But she knows that you're on the case, and that's going to reassure her, and she won't feel devastated.
That's what I mean.
Right.
So,
that's my point.
So we've got to pay close attention. And we as parents, we are remiss in our duty as parents if we don't grab hold of this preparedness, this ability. We have the ability to lessen the impact of the disaster. And you know, we're the kind of people, whoever wants to come to the training, I don't care if you blue, green, or purple. When a disaster strikes, it's going to land on your doorstep like it will land on mine.
That's right.
Will not discriminate. Creation does not discriminate. Only man. Not creation. And it wipe everything you have away the same as it will wipe everything that I have away.
Yeah.
So I say, see, if we don't get together as a human race, we're going to be destroyed. But I say to people of color, people who have been underserved, you have the strength deep down within you to take control of your lives and the lives of your children. I have to mention that earlier today that I talked to Hiram Mason, who was our guest, was supposed to be our guest tonight, and I don't hear that he's on. He was going to announce himself if he came on. But he also told me that he was involved in a car accident today. And I asked him, are you all right? Are you hurting? He said, no, it hasn't too long happened, but I don't feel bad. I feel okay.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll be there, but he's not here. And I have to wonder, perhaps he is now feeling something from that car accident. So if he's not here tonight, I will check with him tomorrow, and maybe we can get him next week. But
if you take care of that, any guest or anyone you want to come on, just like any guest, you invite them and bring them on. We, the three of us, we can't wait for the other one to tell the other one what to do. We got to trust in each other.
That's right.
Without a doubt. Every week we want to have a statement from somebody. We're going to keep on doing this and talking about the disasters because they're not going to go away, and by the grace of God, we're not going to go away. We're going to stay here.
That's right.
We're going to talk.
And
then, of course, when we post the training schedule, more than likely, we will not have a training schedule for the month of October because we are doing some reassessments and we're pulling some strategies together. But when we publish that schedule, the listening audience will certainly get the schedule, and we want people to be ready to sign up for the course. Now, yes. FEMA has, you can go online and you can get some preparedness information. But what we have done, we are constantly looking at the information that's put out by the federal agencies. And we are taking the good of their advice, but we are putting it with our history and our knowledge of the success of how community engagement was done. It's in the books. It was successful, and we are using some of their information because they are the research arm that utilizes the federal funds, your tax dollars, and they can put out good information. But it's a lot of it, and we are bringing it together, and we are making it receptive to the people. Now that we have done that and we are constantly updating and making changes in the training, as we do that, it's incumbent upon you all to come to the table and take the course and then move on to the next course, because we must train an army of trainers who can go out into the community and bring people to the realization that you've got to be prepared. So we are now training the trainers. And we want hundreds and hundreds of people to be trained so they can go back into the community. And with this understanding, we are put the umbrella together by the grace of Allah. We put that umbrella together because we know that people need assistance. They need jobs. They have to be trained.
Right.
Let us train you, and we'll work hard at getting you the kinds of compensation that you need to go into your community and work with the people, to bring the people up.
Yeah.
And this is what we are also doing. Black Belt Wall Street and Summit Environmental Resources and the other organizations that we are pulling into the network. There are funds out there. We want to be in a position to go after them and put them back in your hands, in the community, the people's hands. But these will be the people who are out there in the community talking to other people about preparedness. And you will have the skills, the know-how to talk to them. People need emergency supplies. We have already put, we know the storms that's coming into your community, and we have put the emergency kits together that with the supplies for that those storms that will be coming into your community. We've taken the guesswork out of it, and you'll be able to go online and just simply purchase those kits, and we are making them as cheap as we possibly can. They are much cheaper than if you try to put everything together by going to a store. It's all we are doing it. We have competent people in charge of it. And when there are additional resources available, there are going to be some people who cannot. Maybe we can get your local government to get them for you. But you must have them. Yes, the 72-hour rule is still in place. The federal government does not say we will get to you in less time than 72 hours. That might not be enough time for some people. At least you can have an emergency kit in your home that will last your family for 72 hours, at least 72 hours. And this is the way we have to go, folks. We've got to take control of our lives.
Well, Sister Aisha, Brother Aziz, we ain't going to, we want to leave that message. We have a very strong message, but we're going to have that strong message
everywhere
we're on this show. But like I said, anytime I've noticed that we take a week or so off, it's always low an audience the following week because no one promoted the show. Nothing has been out about the topic of the show. So Karima was able to get something out today, but of course that was an hour before the show came on. So we're not going to waste our value when we don't have the audience that we need to share our values with, because we do have a valuable message to get across. So not unless you two want to continue. If not, then we're going to cut tonight's show 15 minutes short. and just be back here next week. And that'll give us a time to network and bring on our guests and continue our very important discussions and topics. So, Brother Aziz, any closing comments you have? Sister Aisha, any closing comments you might have? If not, then...
No, not for me.
Brother Aziz?
I don't have any other, Bilal.
Okay, in that case, we're going to say good evening, and we'll see each other next week.
Sure.
Okay, and that's what I'm liking to you too.
Thank you.